I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Paulina Ochoa Espejo, Associate Professor of Political Science at Haverford College. We're discussing her 2020 book, On Borders, Territories, Legitimacy, and the Rights of Place from Oxford University Press. Ochoa Espejo works at the intersection of democratic theory and the history of political thought. She is interested in questions about popular sovereignty and borders. She is the author of many articles and most recently the book, The Time of Popular Sovereignty from Penn State University Press. Okay, first of all, Paulina Ochoa Espejo, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Paulina, I love the book. Thank you for it. It really develops a new model for thinking about territorial rights and the legitimacy of borders. It was really impressively argued in detail and synthesizes quite a lot of impressive work across several disciplines. So first of all, well done on the book.
Thank you.
Let me ask you first, as I do always, what was the motivation for writing the book?
Well, it took me a long time to write this book, so there were many motivations along the way, but one of the benefits of taking so long is that you can see it in retrospective. So now I can see, looking back, that there were three main concerns. And one, I would say, is political, and one is mostly theoretical, and the last is personal. Of course, they bleed into each other, but I think that they are distinct to some extent. So the political aspect is that I started to get interested in this topic a long time ago, actually after the Secure Fence Act was passed in 2006. And I was at that point finishing my PhD and I was looking for a second project. And as you may recall, the Secure Fence Act was an act of Congress that secured funding for the original border fence what became the border wall later on. And it became very interested in wall building at borders, not only in the United States, but in general, because I noticed that walls are a metaphor for different political preoccupations. So people project their political concerns on the border, but they hardly ever notice that the border is a place, that it has its own traits, its own physical features, it has its own culture. So I noticed this because when I began to talk to people about this topic, if I was in the United States, I mean, I noticed that people were projecting their preoccupations, because if I said that I was working on borders in the United States, people, I just assumed that I worked on immigration. But if I mentioned the same in Mexico, people would just assume that I was interested in drug trafficking and drug smuggling, because those were the concerns that people in Mexico and the United States have when they think about the border. So I noticed that even though people project their concerns, borders are their own place and they have their own characteristics and their own modes of governance, and they have to just be justified independently. And all of that added to my concerns about the political project, the problem, because I can see that it is dangerous as a political act when the border is projected into other realms. And actually you can see this now today. When you have the Customs and Border Patrol officers running around Portland, there are hundreds of miles away from the border, but they are connected because of the politics of borders. So that was the political concern, but it leads to the theoretical concern. And that is that in the last couple of decades, there has been a lot of interest in the question of territorial rights of states. And this was partially a response to the aspirations of cosmopolitanism and the idea that borders were not important or we shouldn't have borders. And then there was a revival of nationalism as a reaction to cosmopolitanism. So to mediate between these two poles, there were more theorists and philosophers that were looking for convincing arguments to justify territorial rights and borders, but for the perspective of liberal democratic theory. And I share their concern. I think this is a very good objective, and I like that position. But it just seemed to me that liberal democratic thought was not doing a very good job defending that position at all. In fact, I thought they were doing a pretty bad job. So I'm sure we're going to go into detail later on, but that was my theoretical concern. It's also connected to my first book and the definition of the people. We can talk about that probably later on. And the third motivation, which has kept me going over all these years, is personal. And of course, the personal bleeds into the theoretical and the political. But I think that one of the main failure of the theories that I criticize is that they center on identity. And they assume that there are very well-defined groups that belong in specific places. But as you know, I'm a Mexican migrant. So although I have been living in the US for almost 20 years, I'm still pretty much not an American. So it's obvious to me that groups are not very well-defined. They overlap and they cross-cut in many ways. And moreover, it is deeply personal because my colleagues assume that as an immigrant, I should be talking about immigration and I should be talking about borders. However, what I have to say about borders does not come from being an immigrant. It comes from having studied democratic theory. So this tension that I want to point out that the problems at the border are not marginal. They're not only for migrants. They're not only for the people at the margins. They're actually a core concern. They should be a core concern of democratic theory. And I wanted this tension becomes a personal political problem. And I want to point it out. So those are the three motivations. The personal, just let me add one thing, is that what I want to point out is that it's not only a democratic theory, but it's a problem that belongs to everybody, and that borders are about place, and place is also about the environment, which is a problem that we all have. So my personal concern was to lead all of this talk about borders from immigration and identity towards place and the problems related to the environment and natural resources. So that's it. Those are my three concerns.
Let's get into the thesis of the book. I mean, the book is really well structured, I thought, very clear, because the first part is the critical part of the book in which you challenge the standard model of thinking about territory and borders, sort of identity-based approach that you mentioned, that you call the desert island model, which I like a lot, very evocative. The second positive part of the book is where you introduce and defend your own model, which you call the watershed model, and the third part where you apply that positive model. So I figure we could just walk through those three different parts. As far as I got the, maybe I could say the bumper sticker version of your book, which I think you already kind of adumbrated, and I have to warn you, I'm really bad at bumper stickers, but it's so borders are not about identity, but about place, right? And so maybe we could start with that first part about what borders are not, or what we shouldn't be thinking about when thinking about borders, which is your challenge to identity-based approaches. Based on this idea of the desert island model. So maybe just start us off by saying a little bit about what the desert island model is, and how it defends territory and borders.
Sure. So, I mean, I came upon the desert island model when I was trying to answer the main questions of the book. So what I want to know is whether borders are justified, and who has the right to control those borders, and where should those borders be drawn? Because people who talk about territorial rights, you often take those for granted. They're already there. So you're figuring out, so should this territory be ours or yours? Or should this territory be governed this way or that way? But the question of what is that, what is the territory that has borders around them, that's a question that doesn't actually get opened up. So when I was trying to answer the questions and I began to read, I realized that most of the people who write about territorial rights and those who write about borders as well, take for granted that borders look in a particular way. That is, they imagine that they are clearly defined, like as if they were a desert island. So I use them. The model, not because I invented it, even though, I mean, I began to think about it. I mean, this looked like something that is perfectly cut out, like land cut out by water, and something that appears naturally. It's always already there. Like, you know, those islands that you imagine in the middle of the Caribbean with a little palm tree in them. Mm-hmm. And I realized that actually that model was not something that only came to my head. It's something that had already existed in the literature for a long time. And I was really, really shocked when I bumped into this quote by Hume, in which when he's trying to think about how do we come to private property, he actually presents the model of the desert island. And then later on, I also saw that other theorists use the model of the desert island to always invoke what they're talking about. So sometimes they talk about defending your territory, and they think, imagine that you're in an island and somebody else arrives. And it's imagined as being a precisely defined land that as if it were defined by water. So it's distinct. So these are the traits that I see, is there's distinctness. There's also independence. It's just one piece of land that does not depend on any others. So we imagine territories as if they were completely demarcated. And finally, they belong to somebody. It's in Hume's quote, he says, if a group arrives and they can't occupy every little bit, but the group as a whole will occupy the whole territory of an island, like Great Britain, that's what he has in mind. So he has this idea that there's ownership and independence and distinctness. And these three traits have been around for a long time. I think I found that they were all across the Middle Ages, and they go back to canon law. And if you keep on looking, they are there in Roman law. And perhaps they were there before, but at least in the Western canon, they have been there for a long time. So that's how I imagine I picked up on the model of the desert island.
Maybe you should sort of say a little bit about how the desert island that, I mean, how theorists use the desert island to metaphor, I guess, you know, it's really kind of metaphor, as you say, but different theorists use it in different ways, right? So there are sort of, you know, nationalist variants of this. There's sort of Kantian statist variants of this. So maybe you could just sort of elaborate a little bit on how, you know, the desert island model sort of approaches justifying territorial borders, kind of the different ways in which it does it, and then we can start to get into your criticisms of it.
Sure. What is most surprising about this model is that it's so dominant that we often don't even think that it's a model. We just think that this is what borders are. So it's not only the nationalists that think in terms of a desert island. It's also the Kantians, as you mentioned, but even the cosmopolitans or the critical theorists that don't like borders at all, or the critical theorists that perceive that there are problems in defining the model. So a lot of people notice that there is this model, but they can't think of any alternative, or they haven't pointed them out. We just tend to think that this is what borders are. When we think about a country, we imagine that there's a well-defined group that owns the territory. And this is, in the case of the nationalists, is relatively easy because it's a territory that was forged through the ages by a particular group that had a common culture or perhaps were kin. So if you are a nation, the group is well-defined and the territory is the land that the group owns. So you don't necessarily own it in terms of private property, but the model does work in terms of ownership. So there are big differences between the incidents as lawyers and people who deal with private property, the incidents of private property, and the incidents that occur when a group owns a territory. But the logic is the same. There is a land that belongs to the group. So for the nationalist, as I say, is relatively straightforward because they have a story, a historical account of what is the territory that counts and what is the group that counts. Actually, for this reason, I think that the strongest versions of territorial rights available are perhaps the nationalist account. I don't think they're right, but I think that as arguments, they're strong because their assumptions are tailor-made for the model. There are other ways of dealing with this, which is when you doubt that nations are, you know, that Well, I mean, in the ancient myths, the idea of autochthony, like people just sprung from the ground. So if you think that there's no such thing and that the group is actually not defined by just having sprung from the earth, then you begin to have a lot of problems, right? So if you don't think that the assumptions of liberal nationalism or nationalism in short is are plausible, or you don't think that they're normatively correct, then you begin to have a little problem here. So the version, the Kantian version, which is a civic orientation, is that there are institutions, and institutions form the territories where people live, and those who live there, where the institutions have a clout, where they have control, that those are the people who count when it comes to saying whether this territory is legitimate. And it works well with democracy, because one can say, if the people approve of these institutions, then these institutions are legitimate. And As I said before, I actually like this model. I think that this connects well with democratic aspirations, and it connects well with what most people in international law have believed in the last 200 years, that there are peoples with self-determination, and what legitimizes their having their territory is that they govern themselves through their institutions that they chose, and institutions that speak for their rights and their autonomy. So I actually like this version, but it has a very big problem. And the problem is that it's very hard to figure out why would a particular set of institutions be the right institutions. As I said before, we just assume that borders are already there. But if you question borders, you get into all sorts of problems, because when you say, who are the people who should choose? Well, it turns out that the people get defined by the territory. But to know whether the territory is legitimate, you need to ask the people. So you get into a circular relation. This is quite clear in theory. So this is a problem that a lot of democratic theories know as the boundary problem or the paradox of the people. I actually wrote my first book about this, about the problem as it arises in popular sovereignty, that if the people have to decide, first they have to decide who counts. So they have to decide who are the people. And the same circularity arises when you have a Kantian version of territorial rights. You can't have the people decide on what is the right set of institutions that connect a particular group of people to a particular territory in advance. So if you ask the people, then you have to ask the people who are there. But if they have to decide what is there, then you get into a lot of trouble. Does this make sense? Is it clear? Perhaps I can give you an example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like, maybe I could supply the example that I particularly like, because I had a question about it, which is this, the example you give about, I'm not sure if it was someone in your class or someone named Danny, who's Irish, but which I loved. You know, Danny is like a second generation Irish man, but he's American, so he doesn't have Irish citizenship, but he's like identifies really strongly as Irish. And the question is, well, you know, so Ireland doesn't recognize him according to its institutions as an Irish citizen, but maybe it should, because he's like an Irish super fan or something like that. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I found that example as a helpful one, because it's not, you know, it's a fun example, but it sort of brings out the way in which it's sort of not clear exactly who should count as a sort of member of this community.
Right. So for example, if we're trying to decide who counts as a member of the Irish nation, who should be a member of the nation, it turns out that it's usually those who have a passport, right? So those who have a passport get to vote. But now one may say, but how do you define the nation? Isn't it supposed to be a cultural trait? And he's not only a super fan, he has been raised, Danny has been raised according to all the traits that define the Irish nationality. And yet he does not have a passport. The institutions don't consider him an Irish citizen. In fact, you know, this relation of belonging this is a problem of nationalist theory as well, in to some degree, because the nation does not necessarily map into the civic institutions that count in a liberal nationalistic account of the theory. Of course, one could make the nation very expansive and say anybody who identifies with the Irish nation is an Irish citizen. But then the question is not only about identity, and this is what really, really worries me. It's about territory. And again, if we think about the Ireland, this is a perfect example, because the reason why the island of Ireland is still divided into the north and the south is because the counties were gerrymandered to make it easier for those who did not want the independence from the secession or the independence from the Great Britain to happen. So those who decide who get to vote, depending on the territory, actually get to decide the question of secession. So this is a problem that really becomes very obvious. It's not only a theoretical problem. This is what I wanted to point out. It becomes very obvious when you have secession or when you have the invasion of one country in a particular territory. So, I mean, this would work for Ireland or for many other lands, but the example that I give in the book is about a plebiscite that should have happened in a province called Arica in between Chile and Peru. So in the 19th century, when the national states were still being created, Chile invaded a part of territory that had been Peruvian. And to solve the territorial, well, I'm already taking sides when I say that Chile invaded, but when they were trying to decide the question of, I mean, should Arica be in Chile or should it be in Peru? One thinks, well, how do we solve this problem? Well, we just ask the people, right? And that sounds intuitively as the fair way to go. We just ask the people. But the Peruvians did not want to hold a referendum because it really depended on how you drew the area where the territory, where the vote was going to happen. If you drew the vote further into Peru, then the Peruvian side would have won. If you drew the border further into Chile, then the Chileans won. So it really depended on who had the clout of determining the area where the plebiscite would happen. And also, in preparation for the plebiscite, the Chileans began to pack the territory with people from the south. And so they began to pack it. They began to bring institutions, schools. They actually convinced the Catholic Church to make the priests depend on the bishoprics in Chile, such that suddenly the territory that may have been Peruvian to some degree now would have lost the plebiscite. So deciding who are the people who are there, it's always a political question that is really, really fraught. And so the Kantian solution does not give us that precise answer of when territory is legitimate or where should borders go. And that was my main concern. That is the criticism that I leverage against the desert island model in the first part of the book. And
yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a good point to maybe. I was trying to summon up the spirit of Annie Stilts, who I had on several episodes back, because she has kind of a Kantian. She wrote a book recently on territorial rights and so forth. I guess I could ask you directly about what you think about her view, but maybe just to sort of make it more focused in this way, you know, it strikes me what a Kantian might say to what you just said is not that the Kantian wouldn't turn directly to a plebiscite, because presumably the Kantian invests legitimacy in the procedures that are in the institution itself, right? And so, yeah, your question is, well, the existing procedures, but if they're wrong, well, presumably there's some meta procedure about amending the Constitution that itself has procedures, right, that delimits certain kind of membership in that. I mean, I suppose you could say, like, well, what about those procedures themselves? Are those, like, amendment procedures correct? And then you kind of have a regress. But I guess from the Kantian perspective, that would be a rare occurrence, right? I mean, I guess from the Kantian perspective, I don't know how common something like this paradox would be.
Well, I mean, let's if we thought directly about Anistilt's territorial sovereignty, I think that her argument is razor sharp. If you assume that the territorial boundaries are already there, I don't think that that she would say, well, over time, those borders will rectify themselves. And in that way, we share that concern. So, you know, I wrote my book, Political, on this problem regarding the problem of how to constitute the people in 2010. And in there, I argue that the people is actually a process and it rectifies itself over time. Mm-hmm. I think that Annie mm-hmm. shares this view. I think that she thinks that, yes, you know, over time, the people rectifies itself by appropriating the institutions that already exist so that it somehow cleans them up from the original usurpation or the original problems with they existed at the beginning. And I used to think that this was a great solution because, you know, you create the people over time and the people eventually creates its own institutions. But the problem is that this assumes somehow that the border is the same as the rest of the territory and that the border itself is legitimized by the legitimacy of the territorial institutions in general. But remember that this is not only about territorial rights, but it's also about where the border goes. So what that account assumes is that, well, the border goes wherever it goes and eventually it'll get better. But that is really not a very good solution to the problem because the border will always be a sticking point that actually, I mean, in the ideal circumstances, this would not be a problem. But in the everyday, the problem does emerge. And that mm-hmm. is what I wanted to point out in this book, that original sin, if you will, of illegitimacy that comes from the fact that borders are never or they were originally not legitimate and they're never quite legitimate, keeps on coming back in many shapes in actual politics of the everyday. So it's not something that will get solved in the future or something that stays in the past. It pops up in the right now of legitimacy, precisely yeah. because there are all these people who are neither here nor there, right? And so this is, again, the question of the migrants pops up again. How about all these people who are here now and don't count? This, like, the idea is that eventually they will get, you know, incorporated somehow. But meanwhile, and, you know, meanwhile, that doesn't happen. And this is part of what motivated me to write the book, that the ideal models, like the desert island, assume that we will get there one day, but we never quite get there, right? They're always justified borrowing against the future. They have lent their credit to the future. And that is actually a problem that emerges in every day, and as we can see now with all of the problems that are related to the border and emphasized by the border.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, that's really helpful in part because, you know, to point out that particular element of Annie's view. I mean, you know, for Kant, property is always provisional in the state of nature, right? He calls it a kind of possession rather than property. And you might extend that to the international sphere, although Kant himself doesn't quite do that. But you, in the kind of cases about border disputes that you're talking about, you may say that for Kant, you know, states' borders themselves are themselves provisional. And if there are border disputes, then you need to appeal to some kind of international tribunal to address them, right? I mean, I guess that, I mean, this sort of cosmopolitan element of Kant, I guess, is that, that's what, I guess that's what maybe, you know, when I think about the desert island model, it doesn't quite seem to fit Kant, because Kant has this sort of, you know, also a international cosmopolitan right that's built in.
Agreed. I mean, part of what I try to do is to move the discussion to the international level. So I think that the reason why I see Kant as having the desert island model and being very committed is that he really is very committing as seeing the territory as if it were private property. That is, of course, it is not private property because you don't have the legal institutions that grant it. So he doesn't think that there's such thing as natural law that will grant you, as he would do for Locke. But he does think that there's something like belonging. So there has to be something that you can own. So in a way, the it has been defined in advance. And this is something that is actually hard to see, but it's important. When you think about property, you're thinking about like parcels in a cadastral map. That is, you imagine that there's like those little blue lines. The cadaster is like, you know, the legal record of the particular parcels of land. So you see the blueprint and you see those little squares. And so you say, that small square that has these edges, that's mine. And we imagine the world looking a little bit like that. We imagine that there are like blocks of land divided, and this one's mine, that one's yours. The thing is that the world is not divided that way. It can only be divided like that if you have a map. If you have mapped it and you have already decided which, how do you cut it out, if you will. So for Kant, it's very important that you can say that it looks like that. I mean, part of his concern is that he's modeling his ideas of private property in relation to the ideas of imagining the world divided into parts, but also the other way around. He imagines private property because it's already been parceled out. So you have a legal order, you have a territory that you can parcel out, and that is what allows you to have private property. That's why he wants to put the state first. But how do you know that it is parceled out that way? And that is my concern. Mm-hmm. What allows you to know that it could be read as if it were a map with chunks? Geography is not parceled out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So everything bleeds into everything else. So the only way you can say this is one territory and that's another territory is if you already have a legal order. So in this case, again, he has a teleological argument in which he's projecting, once the world has been, once in the future, we have established a legal order that can decide precisely that these borders are legitimate because we all legitimize them, then all the property that we have will be legitimate. So we have a very, very tight teleological argument, and I have problems with that. I did not develop those problems in this book because, again, it's not really about territorial rights, but about borders. I do think that he hasn't paid attention to borders at all because he's presuming this teleological argument that once we all accept this model of the world divided in bits that look like private property, everything will be fine. But we are not there yet. That is a normative hope. So when you say, why should we have that normative hope rather than another normative hope that causes less problems? And that is my criticism of this account. Okay, mm-hmm. So you really want it to be this way. You think it's great, that it would be wonderful. But it isn't wonderful. It causes all sorts of chagrin. why would we have that rather than another model that would be perhaps easier to accomplish, that would cause less trouble? Can we at least try another model that would see if it works, see if there are different accounts that are not based on these assumptions? Can we at least give them a break? The teleological account does not allow you to give it a break. It assumes that states are the best form of political organization. And you say, well, actually, no, they're pretty bad if you think about it. I mean, what kind of form, what form of political organization that eventually makes it have the problem of refugees that we have now, why would it be the best, right? And you say, well, it's not as good as it could be, they would tell you. Right, sure, agreed. But can we try something else for now? And that is my concern of the Kantian account, which is similar to my concern about the Cosmopolitan account. It would be wonderful, but we're not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. And if we are not quite there yet, can we try something else, something that actually exists, something that we can deploy from our tradition, from the existing institutions, and try to use those rather than the ones that are just like a normative pipe dream?
Right. Yeah. And that's helpful to sort of lay out all the sort of cosmopolitan open borders view. Because, right, one possible route that you could take, you know, in response to this is to just reject borders entirely if they have this democratic legitimacy problem. But you don't go that route. Now, I'd be interested maybe when we get to the watershed model to sort of return to the open borders question. But the last thing on the desert island model I just wanted to sort of point out is, one of the things that you are after here is you're connecting the desert island model to a certain model, to a certain account of identity, right? Because identity is at the core of the desert island model, because the desert island model revolves around a conception of self-determination, which requires, of course, a conception of self. And one of the really interesting moves I think you make over the course of the criticizing this is to point out how that turn to identity is, of course, always in danger of devolving into a kind of, you know, xenophobic, put America first kind of view, right? So there's, in addition to problems of democratic legitimacy, there are also sort of just consequentialist problems with the ways in which this model can be abused, right?
Absolutely. So when I say that I don't want to talk about immigration, it's because I don't want us to think that that's the only thing that matters, is such that it's the problem of immigrants, right? I want to think that the problem of immigrants is everybody's problem, right? We are at the core of it, because it's not only that some people will be kicked out, is that at the core, even those who are at the center can get kicked out of their own institutions if we don't solve this problem. It's not only a problem of migrants, but of course the problem of migrants is at the core of what I want to point out. I care about it because there's always the tendency towards to slip into xenophobia. The desert island model, again, is modeled on this idea. Imagine that there is a boat that gets lost and arrives to an island. And so it's now belongs to the crew because they were the first ones that were there and nobody else is claiming this land. And now they have worked it and it's theirs. But it presupposes that there's a collective identity, that there's an I that occupies the property, that would be private property and is the most intuitive model. I occupied it. It's mine. But when it comes to the crew, there is a crew that was constituted before arriving, and it is us, and it's ours. So when somebody else arrives, you can say, this is not yours, this is ours. But the ours is already constituted, right? And when the ours or the us, it's not obvious, and I believe it never is, then you have a lot of problems. So my main concern is that you could always say, well, but we're inclusive, so whomever comes in, you know, that can be part of the institutions. That's not a problem. I think it is, because the group, it's never seamlessly define in terms of identity. Those who are new arrivals will not have the same identity. And if they don't, then there's like the tendency of say, well, then we have to exclude you to make this work, right? Because we can't make space for you because you will break down our institutions. And that is my concern. My concern is that it sort of leads us to a dead end. And it's a dead end that is a dangerous dead end. And so that I would like us to try other possibilities.
Good. Well, that sets us up nicely for your second part, which is your other possibility, namely what you call the watershed model. So let's talk about that, which is in the second part of the book, you introduce and develop this alternative account of territory and borders. So why don't you get us started by talking about what the watershed model is and maybe where it comes from first. You have this great chapter on the topian tradition in political theory as a way to sort of motivate and introduce this watershed model. So maybe you could talk about that and then sort of as a way to lead into discussing the model itself.
Well, actually, before I jumped into the topian tradition, which is probably new to everybody because the name itself is new, and there is a way of thinking about the problem that we just laid out that actually tries to solve it, which is the natural borders account. So just like the nationalists think that the group was there to begin with, or it's a historical creation, and so they know where they belong, part of the nationalist tradition is to think that there are natural borders, that the territory that belongs to a particular group was given in nature, and the people who live there are those who are entitled to live there. Or so the territory is legitimate with the group that is associated naturally with that territory, which is cut off from the rest by mountains or lakes or rivers, has that land. So geographers detest this idea because it has no scientific basis, and also because it has led to, again, to a lot of xenophobia and a lot of violence against particular groups, because it is not true that there's such thing as a natural border. There's like nature does not cut out political territories. And I absolutely agree. But there is something about the idea of natural borders which can be reconstructed. Just like if you think about civic belonging, it's a way of reconstructing other ideas of belonging in relation, like the traditional ideas of belonging were associated with kin, with family or with bloodlines. And civic belonging does not go there, but it retains some of the ideas. I want to do something similar, which is to think there is something about nature that matters, but it's not natural borders associated with nations, but it is the geographical and geological features of the land that we should take into consideration when we think about where borders should go or what makes borders legitimate. So this concern or this idea made me look into, well, haven't people been thinking in these terms for a long time? And it turns out that they have. So a lot of nationalists and Kantians and cosmopolitans insist on this desert island model because that's how we tend to think. And it seems that this thinking in terms of countries and international system of states is something that has been there forever. But it's actually pretty new, and the tradition of thought that sustains it is just one line of thought among many others that are out there, even within the Western canon of thought. So that's what I tried to do. I tried to dig up different ways of thinking about territory in the Western canon of thought, and it turns out that there's a very, very relevant way of thinking about the land that has been forgotten or put aside, which is a whole tradition that deals with how the features of the land and weather and the environment, if you want to call it like that, shape cultures and politics. And I decided to call it the topian tradition because it's very much about concreteness. It's about here and now. It's not about utopias, and so not about the future. It is how are things now? How do they actually shape political institutions? And so if you think about Montesquieu, you probably can begin to think where I'm going with this idea of the Topian tradition. But there are many other thinkers associated with it. Do you want
including,
me to go on?
Including Kant? Including Kant.
Yes, which is, absolutely.
You have to forgive me for my obsession with Kant. It's I'm writing a book on him right now.
Well,
so
you're not the only one.
I know. I mean, what would be most helpful for you? I mean, maybe you want to, we can sort of circle back, because I do have some questions, say, about Rousseau and Kant, who you also include as part of this tradition. But maybe it's most helpful to sort of, you know, lay out what you take to be the model here and how it can help us think about borders in a different way.
Well, I mean, just let me say a little bit more about the Topian tradition, and we'll, sure, as you say, we may come back to it, because I think that what makes it a tradition is a certain features that reappear, and that has to do with the principles being context sensitive. That is, they're not universal; they depend on the particular circumstances, and it is in a way localist in that it takes the characteristics of place seriously. It takes about where you are seriously, and finally it is realist. By that I mean it takes the best available understanding of facts in particular places to constrain models that are overly idealized. And so I think that these are the three main traits of the people that I have in mind, and they illuminate a little bit of what I want to do with the watershed model. So again, this is a model. It's a metaphor. I'm not suggesting that this is the way we ought to do things. It's more a temperament or a way of thinking that is associated with an image, with a metaphor, with a model. And the model that I have in mind is the model of the watershed. So a watershed is also a catchment area, or is the river basin. Is that area where the water drains into a river, and eventually the river drains into the ocean. So now I'm in the Delaware watershed, and I spent some time in the Connecticut River watershed, and a lot of people in the United States live in the Mississippi watershed, and everybody has a source of water, even those places that have underground rivers or only very, very few actual running water on the surface, they belong to a watershed. So I think that this is it's a nice metaphor, because what it's saying is that we are connected and we have relationships and obligations towards one another, not because of who we are, but because of where we are. And the where is it's determined by something that we all share in common, which is water use. So I want to focus on water because it's something that is both universal, but it's also local. It's particular to each group, but it's something that everybody would agree it's of universal importance. So this is in big strokes what I mean by the watershed model. So instead of being distinct, as the desert island model is, it is interrelated, and it is not based on ownership, but it is created by communal organizations and communal institutions. It's neither a private property, is consistent of private property, nor of the state. None of them is primary here. And finally, it's not independent, is thoroughly interdependent. So it has contrasting features with the three features of the desert island model. So that's how I see the model itself, but maybe we can go into detail about like how I make it and what are the things that it can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, I also would be helpful, I think, to talk about an example of how you might think that this watershed model can sort of illuminate or, you know, help resolve a border dispute, you know, in a better way than the desert island model?
Sure. I mean, if we want to start there, I mean, I think that one of the main concerns that I mentioned at the beginning is the problem of the plebiscite. The only mechanism that the international order has thought of until now to deal with the border problems is the plebiscite. But as I mentioned before, the plebiscite is really not a very good model because whomever decides where to hold the plebiscite, whomever decides the question of the plebiscite, whomever determines who are the people, eventually gets to define who will be the winner of the plebiscite. This is a traditional problem of democracy. But we do like this idea of self-determination. And we like the idea that it's those who live there that get to decide. So the only way to solve that problem is to have a there that is what I call is, I'm forgetting my own term now. It's not politically defined, if you will. That is why nationalists sort of have a leg up here, because the nation, in theory, is not politically decided. It's politically independent of the decision. So I don't think that is possible, but there are some things that are more likely to be independent of the politics of determining who the people are. So if you detached it from that question, we can say, how can we make a political decision to say what is there? What counts as there? So obviously the political decision would say, well, there is where my people are. And then you get again into the circularity. But if you say, okay, what is something we must share? We must share the water, whether we are in the same country or not. That would be a requirement of human rights. So it's an ethical requirement, and everybody who thinks in terms of ethics will agree. So it is a universal concern. And if instead of asking, where would you like to go, we think, which are the institutions that would better let us know how to deal with water problems in this particular area, you would be deciding not on who we are, but on what are the institutions that better deal with a common problem in a particular area. So it is still a democratic decision, but it's not circular because we are not deciding on who the people are. We are deciding on where should this water go. Then again, you will say, well, but this eventually will be a question of identity. Well, maybe, but it doesn't have to be that way, right? It could be channeled to be a question of identity, but it could also be channeled to be a question of natural resources. So I can think of topical examples, but the one that I give in the book is how they decided where would the border go between Chile and Argentina, also at the turn of the 20th century. And then there they had already agreed that it would be a natural border. It would be the Andes. But of course, the Andes don't have an obvious line. It's not like somebody put already stakes to say where the Andes, the watershed goes. So what they decided, the Argentinians and the Chileans disagreed on whether to take the highest peaks as the line or to take the water flow line as the line that would determine. And it was more convenient to the Chileans or to the Argentinians. In my view, what should have happened is that instead of having a plebiscite, which didn't take place, but that could have been the outcome, asking the people, would you like to be Argentinian or would you like to be Chilean? They could have asked them, where do you think the border should go if you are to get water and the people on the other side are to get water? And that is a different question that I think to some extent solves the problem that we were dealing with at the beginning.
Right, because it's not a, I found most helpful is that it sort of cuts off the regress that you talk about sort of defining identity by talking about sort of objective features of the world and connecting them to objective basic needs of the human beings in the surrounding area, right? Because I'm imagining, you know, a river basin and then communities on both sides of them. You want to ask those communities who are affected by the water use their views on the relevant you know, political disputes that would arise, right? I mean, so it's not as if, you know, you have to engage in constant regressive questioning about identity, because you're dealing with actual, you know, objective features that are identifiable in the world.
Of course, there are all sorts of political questions that arise. I don't think that they can be, that this sort of cuts politics out of the equation. But it is politics about water. Now, we're not talking politics about identity. And it's not national identity, but local water use. And that actually makes it to be questions of politics that are local politics. And in a way, it makes it more relevant to the question of where would those people who are there want to be? and so in a way, it makes the there not a nation state, not a country, but an actual place where people live. And that allows us to figure out what are the limits of the social relations that should matter, in my account, when we are determining where borders should go.
Yeah, I was trying to think of, you know, a case in which maybe the locals get it wrong or are sort of wasteful, or, you know, that they're the real villains in the case of, you know, abusing the environment or so forth. I mean, on the watershed view, is this something that, you know, then the sort of national government or even the international community should or could intervene in order to sort of put a stop to that? You know, in other words, to interfere with, you say, the sort of local self-determination of a people who are not treating the watershed properly? You see where I'm going?
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
Okay.
So I think that you will eventually have the same problems that you have when you have like communitarian, cosmopolitan, like political views, where you have the locals have their own concerns, and then you have the universalist view and a kind of an international cosmopolitan order with universalist principles that would mediate the local concerns. But remember that what I'm trying to do different is that in here, it's not about your culture. It's not about who you are. What I'm trying to do is to dislodge that way of thinking and say, what we are dealing here is with a common problem of natural resources. So once you dislodge that concern, it actually changes a little bit, because you'll eventually have the same account. So people think about water in different ways, of course, and in all sorts of natural resources. If you think about a mountain, some people see it as a pile of gold that they want to sell in Monaco and sell in other places. Other people see it as their sacred land. So, of course, they will disagree on what is a mountain. But I think that the reason why I particularly like water is that we can all agree that we need it. We can all agree that there is a limited amount of it, and we can all agree that we have to share it. Of course, some people will not want to do that, but that's what I mean, that there's politics always, but this is a normative model. So I think that everybody, at least rationally speaking, would agree that we can share water and that we will have this problem. It will be a relevant problem in the future evermore. So that's why I want to focus on water. That is, every color calls this criteria rooted. I don't know why he uses this term, but he uses when we are discussing about the kind of sustainability. If we are talking about environmental sustainability, it depends on what you consider to be sustainable. What is it that you're trying to sustain, right? So what are your values when it comes to sustaining? And he thinks that the criteria that matters when you're trying to solve a border conflict is one that both sides could agree matter. And it's something also that matters independently of the universal concerns. It matters locally. So I think that in this sense, this is a rooted criterion. Water is something that has culturally specific values and that it's very place specific, but it's also universal. And so that's why I wanted to focus on water as something that would allow us to decide and some of these questions.
Maybe this is a place to, you know, ask about the sort of cosmopolitan angle of this, because I mean, in some ways, you know, in the book, you still want to hold on to borders. And I guess the quick question is maybe at bottom is why, sort of, because the watershed model might, on maybe on a cosmopolitan view, sort of lend itself more towards, you know, open borders, right? You know, why draw borders at all? Because that's, you know, it seems to exclude one from another and just raise problems with trying to create collaborative efforts in developing environmental sustainability. So, you know, it maybe points towards more of a kind of world state model with open borders, in order to, because it seems like addressing environmental issues, indeed, nation states seem to be ill-equipped to actually accomplish that end. So I don't know, you know, if that's something that, you know, how you address maybe that cosmopolitan challenge.
Sure. So as you can see, I mean, a lot of this has a cosmopolitan sensibility, in that I think that, you know, we shouldn't be separating people in terms of their identities. And I don't think that one should have special, very, very important responsibilities to people from their own identity group. And of course, they do matter. I think that they shouldn't be the most salient when it comes to politics. And my concern with the cosmopolitan view is that, first, it's utopian. It just simply does not exist in the world. And it doesn't look like we're getting there anytime soon. And I am more interested in things that are utopian, and institutions and things that already exist, for the reasons that I already pointed out, because I'm actually worried about things that don't exist and that we fetishize as something that we will achieve as a teleological account. And the second one actually is more concerning, which is that, who knows, the cosmopolitan view, they tend to be top-down views. That is, it's an elite group of people who have this idea of how the world should look like, and then they will decide who are the universal principles and impose them from the top. And I think that a lot of the problems that come up are the, when it comes to legitimizing borders, are precisely those, that when we want borders to be legitimate, we would like them to be chosen by the people on the ground. Now, you would say, but then why do we need borders? I mean, we could just get rid of borders altogether and stop, you know, all of this nonsense. Well, my concern is that I do think that borders are necessary, because they are required in order to sustain the institutions that allow us to have autonomy. In that, I agree with the civic account, with the neo-Kantian account of territorial rights. I think that we need those institutions that are bound, and they are bound because they allow us to know who counts when deciding, and because they are in charge of having a particular jurisdictional area. And so ideally there would be a world state, but the world state would have jurisdictions, because you wouldn't want to have like one massive police policing everything, right? There would have to be some kind of jurisdiction. And my concern is, and where do we put those jurisdictions? So it is a problem that would arise with cosmopolitans as well. It is the problem of where do we put those lines that allows us to know up to where authority is allowed. And so I do think that they are very important. We can't do without them. And the sensibility, however, is shared with the cosmopolitans. I mean, I do have that sensibility.
Yeah, I mean, it struck me in a way that, you know, your project is somewhat akin to, you know, it's sort of like, you know, rather than introducing a whole different model, it's something like introducing side constraints, or that's putting it too mildly. I mean, introducing a whole new other important consideration for something like the neo-Kantian view. Like, look, you folks have totally forgot about the sort of geographical and environmental duties that you have. And so we need to we need to remind you of that. I mean, that you're reminding us of that, in other words, right? I mean, it is just sort of, in other words, I wonder, you know, it seems to me that you're sort of, you're synthesizing the best of both worlds in a way, right?
Well, thank you. But my concern, I mean, I think that what we're going through now, the whole pandemic thing really highlights what I had in mind. Look, I am not a national. And there are a whole bunch of people who are not authorized to be in this jurisdiction. And yet we are here. And if we cough on each other, we are going to cause a lot of problems, right? So we do have these duties that come from the fact that we are here, not from the fact that we are something or another, that we identify. And we will, insofar as we are living together, those are concerns that we have to keep in mind. So the way that I justify the view that I have, like it's in the terms of autonomy. It is in the bottom line and liberal democratic view. But I don't think that, I mean, everybody agrees that there should be some special obligations. We all have special obligations to our children or to our families. And nobody denies that we should pay special attention to the people who are very close to us because they are our family. So this is also about special obligations. But there are the obligations of nearness, of I call them place-specific duties. So we are all different. We have different identities, but we have an obligation of not sneezing on one another. Mm-hmm. So the 6 feet apart is a perfect example of a place-specific duty. And it is constrained by space. It is constrained by the concreteness of the places where we are. And I want to remind us that we do live in those circumstances. Even though we are conducting everything by Zoom, the most important obligations that we have to one another is not to give each other a virus. Just like some of the other very important obligations that we have towards one another is make sure that we all have water available for everybody. And that has to do with urbanism and the way we set up things in relation to the other. It's about rocks and it's about the air and it's about water and about bugs. And that is something that has really been neglected. So I'm not inventing anything new. The whole Topian tradition is simply to remind people that there is this long line of obligations that exist and that we have not thought about them. Lately.
Yeah, that's what you say is really great about COVID, in part because I was thinking before you just said that, you know, the COVID situation is leading to increased border control and in some ways that's sort of opposite of what you're looking for. But what you just said makes a lot of sense, which is that, you know, this is a natural phenomenon that is universally shared. I mean, this is a cosmopolitan disease, right? It's a pandemic. So it incurs duties to everyone. So it's actually the opposite of what I was originally thinking. So that's quite interesting. The last thing I wanted to ask you here on this sort of topic is about whether your model, and this we're moving into sort of the applications of your model, if your model can be extended to, I was thinking about border disputes that are, you know, sort of non-natural or basic cultural in nature, or even religious in nature, you know, so like Israel-Palestine, of course, would be the top example that comes to mind in this. Yeah, I mean, is there a way in which the watershed model is relevant to that in the sense of identifying sort of common areas of common places that are shared, you know, that you, in other words, extending the idea of place beyond nature to sort of humanly created, you know, places?
So, of course, everybody who works on territorial rights dreads the Israel question.
So, I asked Annie about it, I really subjected her to it, yeah.
So I don't engage with it directly because there's so many borders in the world, but of course I have thought a lot about it. In fact, I think that I began to think about this water because of Israel, because of the way that the communities, you know, the communities that are there are fighting in to a large degree over the river. There's just one available, and the water. And so, of course, I think that that is a problem that cannot be solved if we think in terms of identity. Of course, there's a few places on earth where people are more committed to identity than in Israel. And insofar as people keep the desert island model, I don't think that there's much we can do in trying to solve it on those lines. However, I began to ask around, and I realized that one of the few areas where the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis share a lot has to do with sewage. And I thought, yeah, that's correct. You know, we cannot share sewage. We must do it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that that means that there is cooperation. There are institutions that, as we speak, are already working on this. And the more, like, hopeful and, how can we say, interesting efforts that I've seen dealing with the day-to-day of the conflict are not trying to solve the conflict once and for all and give a solution that would satisfy both sides, but are trying to find everyday solutions anchored in things that are very, very everyday, particularly water. So I was particularly encouraged by a friend of mine or somebody I met who actually work on delivering electricity, solar panels, wind generated power and water solutions to the communities that are somehow stranded in the occupied territories, Palestinian communities that have been deprived of access to the water grid and the energy grid. And so this is it's a rebellious effort from a group of Israelis. And now it's in community with a group of Palestinians. And so they're not going to solve the whole conflict. But these days, they are delivering water and they are delivering electricity, this group of Palestinians and Israelis, to those communities that were cut off. So if we concentrate it, not in like whose land this is, but how are we going to deliver human rights required resources to all of those who happen to be there, we may see a way of dealing with the day-to-day of living together that may be in a way a kicking the can down the road, and it's a modus vivendi. But this has been a modus vivendi for many years, and it could improve if we improve the angle in which we see it, if we focus on the institutions that already exist, that are not digging their heels in the identity part. Because I could give you a solution and say, I think that it should be divided that way and this way, and these people should go here and these people should go there. But that would not do anything for the Middle East. Nothing at all. But if I provided some solutions on how people can share water provisionally, that at least takes us into another day of kicking the can down the road in the more peaceful possible way and trying to generate better institutions that eventually would get to my normative ideal. But for now, this is the best that we can do.
Yeah, another chapter I wanted to ask you about was the immigration chapter. In the application of the watershed model. So maybe you could say a little bit about why you think the watershed model, or how it can illuminate immigration rights in a certain way. I mean, we so typically have a desert island model thinking about immigration, right, in terms of keeping people out or our ability to let people in and so forth. But your model has some sort of alternative way of thinking about it. Maybe you can sort of expand.
Sure. I mean, just when it comes to the applications, I'm as I said before, I care about concreteness, and I'm not giving solutions that are based on the watershed. I'm not suggesting we should all divide the world in terms of watersheds and then we will all be happy. I don't think that is what I have in mind. What I have in mind is a different kind of orientation to dealing with the problems as they already exist. I don't think that redrawing borders is a good solution. And the same happens when it comes to immigration. I'm not like, I don't think that we have to reform all the views that we have in terms of redrawing borders in order to think about immigration. But I do think that we have to remember that we are here, that immigrants are already there. And what I mean by that is that when we are in the presence of each other, we have what I call place-specific duties. And unless people are allowed to fulfill their place-specific duties, the whole scheme of cooperation in which we rely to have a liberal democratic state will break down. So I think that we have an obligation to, like every liberal democratic state has an obligation to give rights of those who are there. And I have a complicated argument that says it's not just a question of giving rights because they are paying taxes. It's because we owe it to ourselves in the sense that those who are citizens owe it to themselves to give rights to the others, because otherwise they cannot cooperate and they would not allow each of us, each citizen, to do their duty to others. If this is a network and the network breaks down when some of them don't cooperate, we are not helping ourselves if we don't give them rights. So my view is that we have to think of who is us and them in terms of everybody who is in this area, everybody who is sharing those place-specific duties. And that is another way of generating the required legal and moral arguments to say those people who are here should have their rights. And I actually came to this argument by talking to, this was even before DACA, it was a dreamer, somebody who was pushing for the DREAM Act to pass. And he said, like, he was very concerned about this idea. We are, like, the reason why we deserve rights is because we are here. And I agree. So I tried to give a philosophical argument for this position. And this is what I tried to do in the immigration. And why is this a watershed argument? Because it relies on these place-specific duties that are also the ones that motivate and the watershed model. They're about the places where we live, and they're about like the nearness of each other in particular settings and concrete circumstances. So a lot of people ask me, well, you're talking about those who are there, but what does that do to the police, to people who want to come in and are not here? I actually think that this kind of view would be compatible with much more open borders that we have. But it's not an open, like it's not full on open borders view, because I think that a particular state or a particular place can deny entry when this means that the people who come in could not fulfill their place specific duties in certain circumstances. Of course, there are other things that may defeat this view, you know, like some refugees that may not be able to fulfill their place-specific obligations, say somebody who has a disability but really needs a place to be. That's a higher order concern. But one, a country may deny entry to somebody who refuses to fulfill place-specific duties. For example, if we have an obligation to conserve the land and a migrant has a view that wants to destroy a particular area, and those who are already there have a limited case for saying, no, you can't come in. So it's not a full-on cosmopolitan open borders view.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking about the case of sort of guest workers in various countries, but, you know, in Germany, I know best, you know, the idea that you could have, you know, sort of Turkish guest workers who would be in a particular place in a country for generation upon generation, but then not, you know, have full citizenship rights, right? I mean, you know, in your view, you know, the way in which particular people help to create and foster the life of a place, you know, that they become in a way, you know, part of the place, that sort of is the ground for their status as a citizen. I find that to be quite a very interesting alternative to, just the sort of straight up self-determination model where the people get to decide who's in and who's out, right?
Well, again, it all depends on how you define the self and self-determination. Who's the us? I think that the us is those who happen to be there. The us is not like a group that existed independent of the Germans independently of the Turks. The us just happens to be those people who live in the territory we call Germany, in my view.
I wanted to close just by asking you whether you have hope that we're moving in the direction of a watershed view. I think about the development of nationalism across Europe and in the United States as, something that's actually, a bad sign for something like the realization of a watershed view. But maybe I'm wrong about that. I mean, how much hope do you have in that your view could catch on?
Well, let me say first, I do have a lot of hope. Hope dies at the end. Mm-hmm. But it's not about hope. I mean, do I think this is probable? I mean, do I think that this is something that has any traction or could happen? I actually do, because I have no doubt that questions of climate and concerns about natural resources are going to become much more salient. They are already. And if the way to react to this is to have a blood and soil climate nationalism, which is already happening. People think that borders are there to defend us from climate refugees and to keep, to protect our resources from those outside. I think it will become very obvious that this is not a model that we want. And given that there isn't another one out there that is readily available, I think it is not improbable that people will be in the hunt of something that is an alternative to a blood and soil climate nationalism. There are possibilities out there. It's just that we haven't thought in those terms. And if we have those theoretical resources that are at our disposal, I think that this is a good opportunity. And so it's not only a question of hope. I actually think it is quite probable.
Well, I hope that that's true. Good. Thank you for Paulita for this wonderful, interesting conversation. And thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.